This morning we are talking about the Jesus document. We introduced this subject several weeks ago. And by the Jesus documents, we're talking about 27 writings that make up what we now call the New Testament. But originally, those were each written in and of itself. And it wasn't till 150 or 200 years afterwards that people finally started putting them all in one cover in what we call the New Testament. So in a sense, each one of them stands on its own. It has its own author. It has its own audience. It has its own theme. It has its own subject matter. But what binds them all together is that, first of all, they all are a part of the very earliest Christian communities that existed in the first century. And secondly, that they all focus on either talking about Jesus or that earliest community of believers, what we would call the church at its beginning. And we saw last week that all 27 of these writings present themselves as being either by eyewitnesses to Jesus and what he did and what happened to him, or they profess to be written by those people who knew the eyewitnesses and so had come to believe these things to be true based on their own personal knowledge from those eyewitnesses. And we saw last week also that they bear on their face, so to speak, the evidence of being genuine. They come from the right part of the world. The earliest copies of them we can find date sufficiently close to when Jesus lived that it is not a stretch at all to believe they actually, the originals from which those copies were made, were written by people of that first generation. They speak of things and people and places and events which can be independently verified, at least some of them. And when you talk about working with ancient documents, you have to acknowledge that what an ancient document may be talking about, not everything in it may be able to be independently verified. That doesn't therefore make it suspect or unreliable. Instead, you seek to find what things can be substantiated and then use that as reason to believe that if everything we can check out is true, then certainly what we are not able to independently now verify must also be true. That's true concerning not just these documents, but that's true concerning documents concerning any historical figure or event of history, of anyone and of anything that happened before we lived. To a large degree, it's actually even true of things and of people who live today. For the truth of the matter is that I have never personally met nor seen President Barack Obama. Now, okay, you'll say, oh, but I saw him on television. Ah, but that doesn't make you an eyewitness. You saw what someone else wanted you to see. You're trusting them to be the eyewitnesses and now showing you, this time with video instead of just with words, what they saw. You get the point that we, in fact, work in all of our life by trusting others to be reliable, dependable reporters of truth that we personally were not a part of. I've seen the ruins of 9/11. I've seen the place where those two buildings once stood. I saw one time those buildings while they were still there. But now what's happened in between those two, I'm relying on others to tell me. I was witness to what I saw on television and what I've read in the newspapers and other media, but again, I'm depending on others who were eyewitnesses to tell me those things. And there's always those people out there in the world, therefore, who are what's called conspiracy theorists, who always in everything, because they didn't see it themselves, believe someone else has got a conspiracy going to mislead us about the truth. That's true whether it's about the assassination of John F. Kennedy, the fall of the Twin Towers and the 9/11 disaster are about Jesus. And those people tend to be pushed off to the fringes of our society and be considered at least unreasonable and maybe even crazy or kooks or something. But what about these 27 documents then? We've already said they claim to be from eyewitnesses or those who personally knew and had been communicated with by the eyewitnesses. They bear on their face of them enough evidence, if they were any other ancient document, for people to trust them. So why would we treat them differently than we would treat others? Well, perhaps it's because of the subject matter and the claims that are made. Because it's not just a simple historical figure, as majestic as he might have been, like Julius Caesar or Caesar Augustus, or even the not quite so well-liked Emperor Nero. But instead, it's someone who claims to be the very Son of God, that it's claimed of him that he actually did miracles, and that when he was crucified, that he rose again on the third day, that he's alive today in heaven and is coming back again. And some people say, well, that's stretching it just a little too far. I can't believe that, no matter what. Really? Are you really saying that no amount of evidence would ever convince you that? Yes, there are some people that are actually saying that. Well, but what about us? Are we willing to consider the evidence? And so today, we want to take another step in looking at these 27 documents. This time, instead of just looking at them, we want to talk some about, is there any other evidence outside of these documents, beyond just the things within those documents about people and places and events that we can verify are true? Is there any evidence from other sources somewhere around that time that would tend to support what they are saying? I'm going to read to you at this moment from a book written by a man by the name of Josh McDowell. Josh McDowell, in his early 20s, was an atheist, or at least an agnostic. He might say, I'm not sure there's not a God, but I'm pretty sure there's not a God. But by being challenged to actually look at the evidence, not primarily of whether there's a God or not, but whether or not Jesus actually lived and the things said about him were actually true, he ended up not only coming to believe in Jesus, but of course came to believe in God, became a follower of Jesus Christ, and has devoted all the rest of his life to trying to convince other people this is true. And he's not by any means the only person who's done that. There are dozens and dozens of authors and others, speakers and so forth, in the greater Christian community right now who can tell exactly that same story. That I once didn't believe, but I looked at the evidence and am now so convinced that I not only believe it myself, but try to convince others. Well, in Josh McDowell's book, one of the some 50 or 60 or more that he's written, called Evidence for the Historical Jesus, he starts out this way. Did Jesus ever live? He says, most scholars will admit that a man known as Jesus from Nazareth did live in the first century, and that his life was the source of various reports which circulated about him. There's only a few who insist that in their mind Jesus never lived at all. So the question that is hotly debated today is not, did Jesus live, but did Jesus of Nazareth actually live the kind of life the gospel accounts say he lived? In other words, what we read in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Was he actually the kind of person the Bible portrays him to be? There's a stream of new books which continue to present Jesus as anything but the figure described in the gospel accounts. He may be portrayed as a magician, a zealot, an Essene, a guru, a world traveler, as one who used hypnosis, as the husband of Mary Magdalene, with whom he procreated into existence a secret lineage, the Da Vinci Code, and a society to rule the world. He is presented as a Gnostic, an astronaut from outer space, a deceiver who plotted his own resurrection, and is nothing more than a code name for a sacred hallucinogenic mushroom allegedly used by the first Christians. What he's saying is there's all this stuff being produced all the time which presents Jesus as anything but what we read in the four Gospels. But the question is, what's the evidence for any of that? As I've said over and over, most of the people, maybe all of them who write these kind of things, will say, all right, if you want to hear what I believe Jesus was all about, first of all, you need to ignore all that so-called evidence in the Bible. And now, let me tell you how it really was. Is that how we work in the world? Do we say, I'm going to purposely ignore something that is considered the most likely evidence for something and then go off on some wild speculation? That's what they're basically doing. He says, we desire, on the other hand, to present reliable evidence to portray as accurately as possible what the historical Jesus actually looked like. And by look like, he doesn't mean what his physical features were, but rather whether he actually did and said the things we read in the New Testament concerning him. So, what is this extra biblical evidence about? In his book called Runaway World by Michael Green, the very first chapter in that book is entitled Running Away from History. And he says in that first chapter, among many things, that if you're going to choose not to believe in the Jesus that's described in the pages of the Gospels, you're going to have to run away from what history tells us. Now, he doesn't propose, nor does anyone propose, that history beyond the New Testament tells us everything about Jesus that the New Testament does, but that at every point where history intersects with these records, they agree. Imagine it like this. Say you're... We live here in Odessa. I'm not sure exactly how long Odessa has existed as a community and as own. Probably at least 100 years, would that be accurate to say? I know I live up in Lubbock, and we mark our beginning back to about 1890-something as our historical beginning as a town. But say you're rummaging through a thrift store here in town or something like that, and in a box that you've been looking at there, it's obviously an old box of some kind. It looks interesting, so you give 25 cents for it. And when you get home, you have to jimmy the lock to get into it. And inside is a document. And it's a pretty interesting document. It's quite a long one. It talks about some person who purportedly lived 100 years ago in Odessa. And it talks about what they did and who they were married to in his particular case and some important things he did. And yet, you know, you think about it a little bit and say, I've never heard of this fellow before. How would you go about verifying whether or not he actually did live and did these things? Well, you have to go on a search. Anyone who's ever done any kind of genealogical research about their own relatives, ancestors, know what that's about. And you know how so often there is so little evidence you can find. Literally, in our family, I have some great-grandfathers that except for a single name listed on a single piece of paper, we have absolutely no knowledge about him. Does that mean I therefore don't believe he was one of my great-great-grandfathers? It just means that whatever evidence existed at the time has become scarce or non-existent now. That doesn't mean he didn't actually. And so it's the same with this fellow that lived in Odessa 100 years ago. You go on this search and maybe somewhere in the newspapers, if they were publishing a newspaper at that time, and they probably were, and there's probably a weekly at that time in Odessa, you might find some mention somewhere one time or twice about this person. Well, it doesn't tell all about the same things that's in this document you found in the box, but what they do mention does fit together with it. Same time period, same kind of things being talked about. But what if it goes beyond that? What if it turns out this person was a little more important than that, and then you discover there's actually a small street somewhere here in Odessa that has his name on it. Graham Drive, and his name was Bob Graham or something. Or even more than that, what if you found out that for a while, at least in Odessa, 50 or 60 years ago, they actually celebrated Bob Graham Day once a year? All of these things, while not telling us everything that's in this document we found about this man, Bob Graham, would tend to what? Prove he really lived and give more and more credence to what is in this document that speaks in detail about what his life was like and what he... That's what we're facing with the pages of the New Testament. We've got these four documents, particularly 27 actually altogether, but the four that just spend all their time just on Jesus, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And they claim to be from eyewitnesses, and they've got on the face of them things that indicate that they are genuine and true, or at least can everything we can verify is true. But is there anything else out there beyond them that will support that? Well, of course, the other documents in the New Testament, believe it or not, bear witness to these four. They all stand on their own. The letters of Paul is written by someone else entirely than whoever wrote Matthew or whoever wrote Luke. And so if this man over here, writing in these other documents, says some of the same things these do, that gives credibility to it. But when we step outside of those 27 documents, what do we have? We discover that there's historical evidence that still exists today. And we don't know how much has been lost over the centuries, but there's still historical evidence from that time that verifies some of the things written in these documents. Beyond that, we find that there's archaeological evidence that supports some of it. And we also discover there's some institutions and some practices and even some groups of people that came into existence at that time and have continued to exist to today, that they on their own would verify that. Think about it for a few moments. First of all, the historical evidence. Just name a few of them. Some of the more important ones are considered. There was a Jewish historian, lived about the middle of the first century, who was no Christian. He was Jewish, and he actually was a part of the Jewish uprising against Rome, in which Rome sent in their legions and not only crushed the uprising, but eventually destroyed the city of Jerusalem and the great Jewish temple and drove the Jewish people into exile. And his name was Josephus. And he was captured by the Romans during this conquest they were making of the Jewish nation in AD 67, 68, 69, and 70. And he convinced them that rather than turning him into a slave, that because of his education and ability, they should allow him to become an independent chronicler or a historian of their great conquest. That didn't necessarily endear him to the other Jews, of course, because it sounds like he's selling out to the other side. But he ended up writing a number of books, portions of which still exist even today. And in his books about this time, he not only writes about the conquest of the Romans, but in another book he goes back and writes a history of the Jews, going all through the events in the Old Testament and down through what we would call our New Testament up till this time. And he mentions two different places in his book about this, what he calls this wise man called Jesus. And he talks about how this wise man who lived at the beginning of this, what we call the first century, did miracles, according to many people, but that he was executed, and that some have reported that he rose from the dead. Now, he didn't say he believed that. He's just reporting the news, so to speak. In another place, he talks about someone else that connects very closely with Jesus. He talks about this man he calls a prophet named John the Baptizer, who caused a spiritual uprising in the Jewish nation at the very beginning of this same first century, and all the great influence that he had on people because of his preaching. These are things that fit perfectly with what we read in the gospel. Then we read about some non-Jewish historians. There was a man that was considered the official historian of the emperors named Tacitus. He did his work on the 12 Caesars about AD 100. And in his history of the 12 Caesars, obviously he doesn't devote any time to talking about Jesus. Jesus lived in a place 1,000 miles away from Rome. And they didn't have media like we do today, where you could pick up the telephone or send an email or even get online and read a newspaper about what had happened over there. Plus, he's writing some 70 years after most of these things about Jesus happened. But even he talks about that there's this man who was crucified in Jerusalem that was the genesis or the beginning of this movement of these people called Christians in the Roman Empire. He's one of the ones that also lets us know, along with others, that in AD 64, when Rome burned, the emperor at that time, Nero, blamed a small group of religious people in Rome for it. Those people called Christians, who followed someone named Christus, which is just a Latin form of Christ. This is Tacitus. Then another historian, similar time, named Suetonius, writes much the same kind of thing. There was a man who lived in the AD 200s, but that's way later, obviously, but he quotes a book he had that was written around AD 52, written by a man by the name of Thallus. And this Julius Africanus, writing around AD 2, quotes Thallus, who wrote around AD 52, as saying, Thallus said that in the world, in AD, by our time, around AD 29 or 30, there was an eclipse on the same day that a man by the name of Jesus was crucified. And Thallus says in his writing that that was the greatest of all imaginable coincidence, that those two things would happen at the same time. Well, you know, when we read in the Gospels, we find out that when Jesus was on the cross, just up until the moment he died, the sun was darkened. And it was like it was an eclipse. So here's this fellow writing just 20 years after it happened and quoted by a much later author as again saying this man Jesus died on the cross, and saying there was even what seemed to him like an eclipse on that day. And he was writing as an eyewitness, not so much of the crucifixion, but of the darkness happening that day. Of course, there's only one small problem with that. Jesus died during Jewish Passover, and Jewish Passover always took place at full moon, which means the moon is always on the other side of the earth from the sun during the day. And so it's impossible for it to have been an eclipse. But he is confirming that something happened that caused the earth to go dark during the time when Jesus was on the cross. So, is this enough evidence to say everything in the Gospels is true? No, not for some people at least. But it definitely confirms some things that the Gospels themselves say. And so beyond just what the historians of that time and shortly afterwards say, we have some archaeological things that have been discovered. For a long, long time, some critics of the Bible, even those who were scholars, called into question the very idea that there was even a Roman governor by the name of Pontius Pilate. Because almost all the Roman governmental records of this period of time have been lost. And of the ones that still exist, they could find no mention of him. And of course, quite a bit is made in the Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John that Pilate was the governor at this time. He had the final say over whether he'd be crucified or not, and he sent him to the cross. And so they'd say, this can't be true because there never was a real person named Pontius Pilate. Oh, but now they've started to find some evidence, even 2,000 years later, of that. The most recent and maybe most significant thing is they, in an excavation of a building that was built in the first century by the government in the Holy Land, as we call it today, they found, in what amounted to the cornerstone of this building, an inscription in which it says, built by Pontius Pilate and dedicated to the honor of the emperor. That's some pretty hard, cold evidence that such a person did. And they have now started to find portions of some histories written about this time in which this man is in fact mentioned as having been governor in that land during this period of time. But some of the more fascinating things, if you have heard of this in the last few years, they found this box cut out of stone called an ossuary. An ossuary was a common way for people to be buried in New Testament times in that part of the world, especially along the eastern edge of the Mediterranean. When people would die, they'd put them into a tomb. They wouldn't bury them in the ground like we do, but they'd put them in a tomb more like a cave, especially if they were a person of any significance. And then about a year later, it was the responsibility of the head of the family of that man or person who died to go reopen the tomb. And by that time, the body itself would have decayed and there would be nothing left but the bones. And a box would have been made to gather up those bones and put them into this box, called a bone box or an ossuary. They're all over the place over there. If you go over as a tourist, I understand if you're not careful, someone will try to sell you one. It's probably a fake, but they treat them like, you know, trinkets or something you can carry home from the Holy Land to prove that you were there to remember it by. But it was an ossuary. But what was so fascinating about this ossuary that has been in the news is the inscription on the outside of it. It claims to be the ossuary in which, at one time, the bones of James, the brother of Jesus. And so there's a big flap in the archaeological community and historical community, and preposterous, can't be true. Just last year, the Jewish court, which is no friend of Christianity, as you can imagine, they're Jewish. The Jewish court ruled it was authentic. Now, is it the same James that we know was a brother of the same Jesus we know? Both James and Jesus were common names in that, but you certainly can't rule it out. But even more significant is how, as they continue to build over there and the city of Jerusalem needs more and more land, and so they carefully excavate any unused land to make sure there's nothing historically significant buried under the ground or, you know, ruins or something before they build out to it. They keep finding tombs. One that was found in the community of Talpiot, which was one of the neighborhoods in Jerusalem. They opened it up, and as I recall, at this moment, it had like 11 ossuaries in it. And there was nothing very significant about most of them. They did find, I think, inside of more than one of the ossuaries, coins that were minted around A.D. 48 to A.D. 54. They were actually in there with the bones, probably put in there by the grieving family as some kind of a tribute or whatever. It also helps date them very exactly. But on the outside of at least two of those ossuaries were crosses. Someone put the emblem of a cross in AD 50 on a box in which someone's bones were buried. Why do we put crosses on the outside of boxes in which people are buried? Already by AD 50, just 20 years after Jesus supposedly died on a cross, people are already putting crosses on the outside of the boxes, believers in Jesus. And that's not all. There was inscriptions on two of those boxes. Well, the same ones that had the crosses on. And on one of them it says, Jesus raised. And the other one says, Jesus saved. Talking about the two people. Jesus supposedly died on the cross. Does that prove that Jesus lived? No, it proves that when two people were buried just 20 years after the New Testament said he lived, that the people that buried them believed that Jesus could raise them from the dead or save them. And somehow they thought there was something important about a cross. They've also discovered another tomb, a much more elaborate one, where the rich people in Jerusalem would be buried in the first century, in which they found among the ossuaries in it one very ornately decorated one. Clearly this was a very important person. And it says on the box that it contains the remains of a person named of the priesthood and son of, again, the man who stood at the trial of Jesus, the Jews, and condemned him and sent him on to Pilate was a man. We can't say positively it's the same person, but everything indicates that seems the majority of scholars are already believing this is the same. And that's important because up until now we had almost no evidence outside the New Testament that a person named Caiaphas actually lived. The Jewish records had been destroyed. The Roman records wouldn't have had any reason to mention it because he wasn't a Roman official. The Roman government was only minimally involved with him. But here's something right out of the first century, early first century, in which an elderly man, it says, the archaeologists and those who have examined the bones said it seems to be a man about age 60 when he is buried here. What's also interesting, there was another ossuary in that same with a cross on it. Not his, but somebody else in his had come to believe the same thing those two folks buried in that other tomb we were. Now in AD 41, a new emperor came to the throne in Rome. His name was Claudius. And for some reason, in his very first year as emperor, he issued an edict that apparently was posted throughout the Holy Land. Only one copy of it has been found so far. It was actually carved into a block of marble and was posted in the city of Nazareth, in which the emperor has declared that anyone found going into a tomb and removing the dead bodies would be subject to execution. What? What do you think the report that Pilate had sent to Rome a few years before had said happened when this report got out that this man that Rome had executed was missing 3 days later? Do you think he sent a letter to Rome that said he rose from the dead? There's people walking around who claims he rose from the dead. I suspect he wrote just exactly what we read in the gospel account. And that is that his soldiers told him, the gospel accounts say they were paid to say, that the disciples came and stole the body. That somehow 11 dispirited, frightened Galilean fishermen overpowered 4 Roman green berets, which is what they put at the tomb, their very best men, somehow overcame 4 of them and then took the body away. And they can't find them, and they can't find the body. That was the claim. I suspect that's what Pilate's report to Rome said. A few years later, gradually, the wheels of government move slowly, we know. Claudius sees this growth of this cult that believed in this man Jesus, and so he issues this edict his very first year as that from this point forward, anybody that takes a dead body out of a tomb in the Holy Land will be executed. Most historians think this is the government's response to the reports of the resurrection of Jesus. But even beyond that, one of the most common things we think of today, some of the most common things we think of today concerning Christianity and our symbols go all the way back into the first. We've already mentioned the cross appearing on ossuaries, bone boxes of those who had died who claimed to believe this thing about Jesus. But then there was a matter of the fish. You see it today, don't you? People wear jewelry with a fish on it. You might see a little emblem on the back of their car with a fish. But do you know what it means? To the earliest Christians, a fish to them was uniquely a symbol of. At least by AD 100, they'd even found out a way to take the Greek word for fish, which is ichthus, and make each one of the letters in ichthus stand for Jesus, Son of God, Savior. If you said that in Greek and take the first letter of each word, it would spell out ichthus. We find the symbol of the fish being used all the way back into the first century of this peculiar group who believed in Jesus. And not just because they had found a way to make the word spell out as sort of an acronym for who they believed Jesus was, but because of the things that Jesus did having to do with fish, feeding the 5,000 and catching the fish on two different occasions in the nets and so forth, if you know your gospel story. It's such an odd little thing. It's just the kind of thing every historian lives for, because it says this is too much to be coincidental. There has to be something. But then we also say not only documentary evidence, that's the history, not only archaeological evidence, but even practices and institutions. We know that from the, at least by the middle of the first century, there were groups of people scattered throughout the Roman Empire, and this is just a matter of fact in history, who claimed to be believers in a person named Jesus. Now how, just 20 years after a person named Jesus supposedly died, could there in fact be people all over the Roman Empire claiming to be believers in him? And by AD 64, even some of them were being persecuted to the point of death by the Roman government because of their obstinate belief in him. That is, they would rather die rather than give up their faith in him. How could they so quickly arise when they lived in the very generation when they could know if he was real or not, and the things that were reported about him were true or not? And that group has continued to exist. We call it the Christian Church. It's existed now. And the Christian Church, using it in the broad sense of Christianity, does two peculiar things that also date all the way back to the first. One, the Christian Church baptizes. Now, some of them may just sprinkle water on their forehead or squeeze a little bit on their forehead and call that baptism. Others immerse them like we do here under the water. But that's a peculiar thing. Very few groups in the world, even religious groups in the world, practice something. But we've practiced it 2,000 years. It goes all the way back to the first century. The connection is that in the Gospels, Jesus told his disciples to do it. And he said people couldn't be counted as disciples of his unless they were baptized. For 2,000 years, has practiced something. And the other thing the Christian community has practiced since the very first century, and the very earliest records we have, not just in the New Testament, but records outside of it that tells what these Christians did, is they get together every week and they celebrate together something called the Lord's Supper. They break bread together and drink together, saying they're remembering their Savior, something Jesus, according to the gospel accounts, commanded them to do as often as they did it, and do it until he comes. Again, these are the kind of things that historians live for, live to discover, if it had to do with anything other than Christianity, but because Christianity has been around so long, they don't necessarily think about it. It's how it relates to them. But what are we saying? While the evidence may not be considered overwhelming by some to support the facts in the gospel account, the facts that have been discovered outside of the gospel accounts uniformly support what we're reading in the gospel. Don't find any records from that period of time or within 100 years of that time afterwards in which the records are saying something directly contradictory or even opposed to. Now, sometimes it may be written by enemies of Christianity. It may be by critics of Christianity, and definitely by unbelievers of Christianity. And so they may have a different slant on it, but they're confirming it, even when that wasn't necessarily their intention. They're acknowledging that there was a Jesus, that he was considered a miracle worker, that his believers said he was the Son of God, that he was crucified on a cross by the Roman government under Pontius Pilate, and that it was reported he was risen from the dead. And as that message started to be spread across the Roman world, that people in almost every city came to believe it, and believed it so strongly that they lived their lives as followers of his, and even died violent deaths sometimes in persecution rather than give up such faith. And they marked their tombs with crosses, and they put the sign of the fish on their doorpost, and every week they gathered together with other people who believed like they did, and they were all baptized believers, and they celebrated a communion. That all supports in the truthfulness of them. That's why the Apostle Paul, in Acts chapter 26, as he was standing on trial before a king by the name of Agrippa at that time. Agrippa was a man who had actually grown up in the Holy Land, partly grown up in the Holy Land, partly grew up in Rome, because he was connected into the Roman government, even though he wasn't Roman. Now the Romans had made him king over this territory, just like his grandfather and great-grandfather had been. And so Paul's standing on trial before him. The Jews have arrested him and demanded that the Romans execute him for spreading this doctrine, this teaching about Jesus. And so as Paul's standing before him, giving his defense, there's someone else also sitting up there next to Agrippa. He's the governor of that area named Festus. Festus doesn't know anything about any of this. He'd never lived here before. He knew nothing about what was believed in this part of the world until he arrived. And so as Paul is explaining what he believes and why he believes it, it says there in Acts 26:24, at this point, Festus interrupted Paul's defense. "You are out of your mind, Paul." He's hearing Paul talk about a man who did miracles and was a fulfillment of prophecies from the old Jewish scriptures, and that even when he was executed, rose from the dead on the third day, and that there were eyewitnesses to that. And Paul had opposed that himself and thought it was untrue, but had himself met Jesus on the road to Damascus in a vision and came to believe it was true and had devoted the rest of his life to preaching it. That's what he just got through telling them. And Festus said, "You're out of your mind, Paul. This sounds too far out for him. Your great learning is driving you insane." "I am not insane, most excellent Festus," Paul replied. "What I am saying is true and reasonable. The king," talking about Agrippa here, "the king is familiar with these things, and I can speak freely to him. I am convinced that none of this has escaped his notice, because it was not done in a corner." Paul can actually appeal to Agrippa and say, "Agrippa, you know these things. Whether you believe that the conclusion to be drawn is the same as what I believe, you know these things happened. You know about Jesus. You know about those miracles that he reportedly did and tens of thousands of people saw him do. You know about him being crucified. You know of the reports of his resurrection. You know how this belief in him has spread ever since then. Because everyone who had the chance, while it was all still fresh and present, to look at the evidence, all came to believe it was true." And it's interesting what the king's response to this was. He didn't say, "Paul, you're incorrect. I've checked this out carefully and I've found out this isn't true." That's not his response. Instead, the king said to Paul, "Do you think that in such a short time you can persuade me to..." I think Agrippa was persuaded almost to draw the same conclusion Paul did. He knew the facts were true. He just was not willing. Well, what about us? We've got the facts. The Christian community had been right for the last 2,000 years. These 27 documents are about a real person who really lived and who did these things. We have every reason to believe.